22, 310 yards, 4 TDs, 1 pick. Also rushed for 98 yards, 1 TD. Kinda reminded me of the old high school days. Having fun. Love, Rick. And to Arnie. Undefeated here in Parma, first game, 5 TDs, 4 by air, 1 by ground. A real stud. No, I will not, under any circumstances, play arena football. Have you talked to Tampa Bay? Chapter 13. The Brumcardo Palazzo was a grand 18th-century edifice on Viale Mariotti, overlooking the river and a few blocks from the Duomo. Rick made the walk in 10 minutes. His Fiat was tucked away on a side street in a fine parking space, one he was reluctant to relinquish. It was late Sunday afternoon, the day after the great victory over the bandits, and though he had no plans for the evening, he certainly didn't want to do what he was about to do. As he strolled up and down Viale Mariotti, trying to analyze the palazzo without looking stupid and searching desperately for its front door, he asked himself once again how he had been boxed into this corner. Sam. Sam had applied the pressure, with help from Franco. He finally found the doorbell, and an ancient butler appeared without a smile and reluctantly allowed him to enter. The butler, dressed in black with tails, quickly scanned Rick for proper attire and appeared not to approve. Rick thought he looked rather nice. Ink-colored navy jacket, dark slacks, real socks, black loafers, white shirt and tie, all purchased from one of the stores Sam had suggested. He almost felt like an Italian. He followed the old goat through a great hall with high frescoed ceilings and shiny marble floors. They stopped at a long parlor, and Signora Brumcardo came rushing forth. She spoke sultry English. Her name was Sylvia. She was attractive, heavily made up, nicely nipped and tucked, very thin, and her thinness was accented by a sparkling black gown that was as tight as skin. She was about 45, 20 years younger than her husband, Rodolfo Brumcardo, who soon appeared and shook hands with his quarterback. Rick had the immediate impression that he kept her on a short leash, and for good reason. She had the look. Anytime, anywhere. With a thick accent, Rodolfo said in English that he was so sorry for not having met Rick sooner, but business had kept him out of town and so on. He was a very busy man with lots of deals. Sylvia watched with large brown eyes that were easy to dwell on. Mercifully, Sam appeared with Anna, and the conversation became easier. They talked about yesterday's win and, more important, the article on the Sunday sports page. NFL star Rick Dockery had led the Panthers to a smashing win in their home opener, and the color photo was of Rick crossing the goal line with his first rushing touchdown in a decade. Rick said all the right things. He loved Parma, the apartment and car were wonderful, the team was a blast, couldn't wait to win the Super Bowl. Franco and Antonella entered the room, and the embracing rituals were carried out. A waiter stopped by with glasses of chilled Prosecco. It was a small party, the Brumcardos, Sam and Anna, Franco and Antonella, and Rick. After drinks and appetizers, they left on foot, the ladies in gowns and high heels and minks, the men in dark suits, everybody speaking Italian at once. Rick smoldered quietly, cursing Sam and Franco and old man Brumcardo for the absurdity of the evening. He'd found a book in English on the region of Emilia-Romagna, and though most of it was about food and wine, there was a generous section on opera. Very slow reading. The Teatro Reggio was built in the early 19th century by one of Napoleon's former wives, Maria Luisa, who preferred life in Parma because it kept her far away from the emperor. 5 levels of private boxes looked down on the audience, the orchestra, and the expansive stage. Parmesans consider it the finest opera house in the world, and they also consider opera their birthright. They are acute listeners and fierce critics, and a performer who leaves with applause is prepared to face the world. A faulty performance or a missed note often leads to noisy disapproval. The Brumcardo box was on the 2nd level, stage left, excellent seats, and as the party settled in, Rick was awed by the ornate interior and the seriousness of the evening. The well-dressed crowd below them buzzed with nervous anticipation. Someone waved. It was Carl Korberg, the large Dane who taught at the university and was trying to play left offensive tackle. He had missed no fewer than 5 clean blocks against the bandits. Carl was wearing a fashionable tuxedo, and his Italian wife looked splendid. Rick admired the ladies from above. Sam stayed at his elbow, anxious to help the novice through his first performance. "These people are crazy about opera," he whispered. "They're fanatics." "And you?" Rick whispered back. "This is the place to be. Believe it or not, in Parma, opera is more popular than soccer."
"And more popular than the Panthers?"
Sam laughed and nodded at a stunning brunette passing just under them.
"How long will this last?"
Rick asked, gawking.
"Couple of hours." "Can't we just skip out at intermission and go have dinner?"
"Sorry."
"And dinner will be superb." "I have no doubt."
Signor Bruncardo handed over a program.
"I found one in English," he said.
"Thanks." "You might want to give it a glance," Sam said. "Opera is sometimes hard to follow, at least from a plot angle." "I thought it was just a bunch of fat people singing at full blast."
"How much opera did you see in Iowa?"
The lights dimmed slightly and the crowd settled down.
Rick and Anna were given the two tiny velvet seats at the front of the box, very near the ledge, with perfect views of the stage. Tucked in closely behind them were the rest. Anna pulled out a pencil-like flashlight and pointed it at Rick's program. She said softly,
"This is a performance of Otello, a very famous opera written by Giuseppe Verdi, a local from Busseto."
"Is he here?"
"No," she said with a smile. "Verdi died 100 years ago. He was the world's greatest composer when he lived. Have you read much Shakespeare?"
"Oh, sure."
"Good."
The lights went dimmer. Anna flipped through the program, then aimed the light at page 4.
"This is the summary of the story. Give it a quick look. The opera is in Italian, of course, and it might be a bit hard to follow."
Rick took the light, glanced at his watch, and did as he was told. As he read, the crowd, quite noisy in anticipation, settled down, and everyone found a seat. When the theater was dark, the conductor marched out and received a rousing ovation. The orchestra came to attention, then began playing. The curtain rose slowly to a silent, still audience. The stage was elaborately decorated. The setting was the island of Cyprus. A crowd was waiting for a ship, and on the ship was Otello, their governor, who'd been off fighting somewhere with great success. Otello was suddenly on the stage singing something like, "Celebrate, celebrate," and the entire town joined in the chorus. Rick read quickly while trying not to miss the spectacle before him. The costumes were elaborate, the makeup thick and dramatic, the voices truly sensational. He tried to remember the last time he had watched live theater. There'd been a girlfriend at Davenport South who starred in the senior play 10 years earlier. A long time ago. Otello's young wife, Desdemona, appeared in scene 3, and the spectacle took a different turn. Desdemona was stunning. Long, dark hair, perfect features. Deep brown eyes that Rick could see clearly from 80 feet. She was petite and thin, and fortunately her costume was tight and revealed marvelous curves. He scanned the program and found her name, Gabriella Balini, soprano. Not surprisingly, Desdemona soon attracted the attention of another man, Rodrigo, and all manner of backstabbing and scheming began. Near the end of Act 1, Otello and Desdemona sang a duet, a high-powered, romantic back-and-forth that sounded fine to Rick and those in the Bruncardo box, but others were bothered by it. Up in the 5th level, the cheap seats, several spectators actually booed. Rick had been booed many times in many places, and the booing had been easy to shake off, no doubt helped by the sheer magnitude of football stadiums. A few 1,000 fans booing was just part of the game, but in a tightly packed theater with only 1,000 seats, 5 or 6 rowdy fans booing heartily sounded like 100. What cruelty! Rick was shocked by it, and as the curtain dropped on Act 1, he watched Desdemona standing stoically with her head held high, as if she were deaf.
"Why did they boo?"
Rick whispered to Anna as the lights came on.
"The people here are very critical. She has been struggling."
"Struggling? She sounded great."
"And looked great, too.
How could they boo someone so gorgeous?"
"They think she missed a couple of notes. They are pigs. Let's go."
They were on their feet as the entire audience stood for a stretch.
"So far, you like?"
Anna asked.
"Oh, yes," Rick said, and he was being truthful. The production was so elaborate. He had never heard such voices. but he was baffled by the boo birds in the top level. Anna explained,
"There are only about 100 seats available to the public, and they are up there," she said, waving at the top. "Very tough fans up there. They are serious about opera and quick to show their enthusiasm, but also their displeasure. This Desdemona was a controversial selection, and she has not won over the crowd."
They were outside the box, taking a glass of Prosecco and saying hello to people Rick would never see again. The first act lasted for 40 minutes, and the break after it lasted for 20. Rick began to wonder how late dinner might be. In Act Two, Otello began to suspect his wife was fooling around with a man named Cassio, and this caused great conflict, which, of course, was played out in dazzling song. The bad guys convinced Otello that Desdemona was being unfaithful, and Otello, with a hair-trigger temper, finally vowed to kill his wife. Curtains. Another 20-minute break between acts. Is this really going to last for 4 hours? Rick asked himself. But then he was anxious to see more of Desdemona. More booing, and he might scurry up to the fifth floor and punch someone. In Act Three, she made several appearances without provoking any boos. Subplots spun in all directions as Otello continued to listen to the bad guys and became more convinced that he must kill his beautiful wife. After 9 or 10 scenes, the act was over, and it was time for another recess. Act Four took place in Desdemona's bedroom. She got murdered by her husband, who soon realized that she was faithful after all. Distraught, out of his mind, but still able to sing magnificently, Otello produced an impressive dagger and gutted himself. He fell onto his wife's corpse, kissed her 3 times, then died in a most colorful fashion. Rick managed to follow most of this, but his eyes rarely left Gabriella Balini. 4 hours after he first sat down, Rick stood with the audience and applauded politely at the curtain call. When Desdemona appeared, the booing returned with a fury which provoked angry responses from many of those on the floor and in the private boxes. Fists were pumped, gestures made. The crowd turned on the disgruntled fans way up there in the cheap seats. They booed even louder, and poor Gabriella Balini was forced to take a bow with a painful smile, as if she heard nothing. Rick admired her courage and adored her beauty. He thought Philadelphia fans were tough. The Palazzo's dining room was larger than Rick's entire apartment. A half dozen other friends joined them for the post-performance feast, and the guests were still wrung out from Otello. They chatted excitedly, all at the same time, all in rapid-fire Italian. Even Sam, the only other American, seemed as animated as the others. Rick tried to smile and act as though he was as emotionally charged as the natives. A friendly servant kept his wine glass full, and before the first course was finished, he was quite mellow. His thoughts were on Gabriella, the beautiful little soprano who had not been appreciated. She must be devastated, ruined, suicidal, to sing so perfectly and emotionally and not be appreciated. Hell, he had deserved all the booing he'd received, but not Gabriella. There were 2 more performances, then the season was over. Rick, deep in the wine and thinking of nothing but the girl, thought the unthinkable. He would somehow get a ticket and sneak into another performance of Otello. Chapter 14. Monday's practice was a half-hearted effort at watching game tapes while the beer flowed. Sam ran through the film, growling and bitching, but no one was in the mood for serious football. Their next opponent, the Rhinos of Milan, had been easily thumped the day before by the Gladiators of Rome, a team that rarely contended for the Super Bowl. So, contrary to what Coach Russo wanted, the mood was set for an easy week and an easy win. Disaster was looming. At 9:30, Sam sent them home. Rick parked far from his apartment, then hiked across the center of town to a trattoria called Il Tribunale, just off Strada Farini, and very near the courthouse where the cops liked to take him. Pietro was waiting, along with his new wife, Ivana, who was very pregnant. The Italian players had quickly adopted their American teammates. Sly said it happened every year. They were honored to have real professionals playing on their team, and they wanted to make sure Parma was hospitable enough. Food and wine were the keys to the city. One by one, the Panthers invited the Americans to dinner. Some were long meals in fine apartments, like Franco's. Others were family feasts with parents and aunts and uncles. Silvio, a rustic young man with a violent streak, who
who played linebacker and often used his fists when tackling, lived on a farm 10 kilometers from town. His dinner, on a Friday night in the renovated ruins of an old castle, lasted 4 hours, included 21 blood relatives, none of whom spoke a word of English, and ended with Rick sprawled safely on a bunk in a cold attic. A rooster woke him. Later, he learned that Sly and Trey had been driven away by a drunk uncle who couldn't find Parma. This was Pietro's dinner. He had explained that he and Ivana were waiting on a newer, larger apartment, and the one they were presently in was simply not suitable for entertaining. He apologized, but he was also quite fond of Il Tribunale, his favorite restaurant in Parma. He worked for a company that sold fertilizer and seeds, and his boss wanted him to expand their business into Germany and France. Thus, he was studying English with a passion and practiced on Rick every day. Ivana was not studying English, had never studied it, and showed no interest in learning it now. She was rather plain and plump, but then she was expecting. She smiled a lot and whispered when necessary to her husband. After 10 minutes, Sly and Trey strolled in and collected a few of the customary second looks from the other diners. It was still unusual to see black faces in Parma. They settled around the tiny table and listened as Pietro practiced his English. A thick wedge of Parmigiano arrived, just to munch on while food was contemplated, and soon there were platters of antipasti. They ordered baked lasagna, ravioli stuffed with herbs and squash, ravioli smothered in a cream sauce, fettuccine with mushrooms, fettuccine with a rabbit sauce, and anolini. After a glass of red wine, Rick glanced around the small dining room, and his eyes locked onto a beautiful young lady sitting about 20 feet away. She was at a table with a well-dressed young man, and whatever they were discussing was not pleasant. Like most Italian women, she was a brunette, though, as Sly explained several times, there was no shortage of blondes in northern Italy. Her dark eyes were beautiful, and although they radiated mischief, they were, at that moment, not at all happy. She was thin and petite, fashionably dressed, and... "What are you looking at?" Sly asked. "That girl over there," Rick said before he could stop himself. All five at their table turned for a look, but the young lady did not acknowledge them. She was deep in a troubled conversation with her man. "I've seen her before," Rick said.
"Where?"
Trey asked.
"At the opera last night."
"You went to the opera?"
Sly asked, ready to pounce.
"Of course I went to the opera. Didn't see you there."
"You were at opera?"
Pietro asked with admiration.
"Sure. Otello. It was spectacular. That lady over there played the role of Desdemona. Her name is Gabriella Bellini."
Ivana understood enough of this to glance a second time. She then spoke to her husband, who did a quick translation.
"Yes, that's her."
Pietro was very proud of his quarterback.
"Is she famous?"
Rick asked.
"Not really," Pietro said. "She's a soprano. Good, but not great."
He then ran this by his wife, who added a few comments. Pietro translated.
"Ivana says she's having a rough time."
Small salads with tomatoes arrived, and the conversation returned to football and playing in America. Rick managed to contribute while keeping an eye on Gabriella. He did not see a wedding band or engagement ring. She did not seem to enjoy the company of her date, but they knew each other very well because the conversation was serious. They never touched. In fact, things were rather frosty. Halfway through a monstrous plate of fettuccine and mushrooms, Rick saw a tear drop from Gabriella's left eye and run down her cheek. Her companion didn't wipe it for her. He seemed not to care. She barely touched her food. Poor Gabriella. Her life was certainly a mess. On Sunday night she gets booed by the beasts at Teatro Reggio, and tonight she's having an ugly spat with her man. Rick couldn't keep his eyes away from her. He was learning. The best parking places opened up between 5 and 7 p.m., when those who worked in the center of the city left for home. Rick often drove the streets in the early evenings, waiting to pounce on a fresh opening. Parking was a rough sport, and he was very close to either buying or leasing a scooter. After 10 p.m., it was almost impossible to find a space anywhere near his apartment, and it was not unusual to park a dozen blocks away. Though towing was rare, it did happen. Judge Franco and Signor Bruncardo could pull strings, but Rick preferred to avoid the hassle. After practice Monday, he had been forced to park north of the center, a good 15 minutes by foot from his apartment. And he'd parked in a restricted space reserved for deliveries. After dinner at Il Tribunale, he hustled back to the Fiat, found it safe and untowed, and began the frustrating task of finding a spot closer to home. It was almost midnight when he crossed Piazza Garibaldi and began prowling for a gap between two cars. Nothing. The pasta was settling in, as was the wine. A long night's sleep wasn't far away. He cruised up and down the narrow streets, all of which were lined with tiny cars parked bumper to bumper. Near Piazza Santa Fiora, he found an ancient passageway he had not seen before. There was an opening to his right, a very tight squeeze, but why not? He pulled even with the parked car in front and noticed a couple of pedestrians hurrying along the sidewalk. He shifted into reverse, released the clutch, turned hard to the right, and sort of staggered back into the space, hitting the curb with the right rear wheel. It was a lousy miss. Another effort was required. He saw headlights approaching, but did not worry. The Italians, especially those who lived in the center, were remarkably patient. Parking was a chore for all of them. As Rick pulled back into the street, he had the quick thought of moving on. The space was very tight, and it could take some time and effort to maneuver into it. He'd try once more. Shifting and turning and trying to ignore the headlights that were now very close behind him, he somehow allowed his foot to slip off the clutch. The car lunged, then died. The other driver then sat on the horn, a very loud, shrill horn from under the hood of a shiny, burgundy BMW. A tough guy's car. A man in a hurry. A bully, unafraid to hide behind locked doors and honk at someone struggling. Rick froze, and for a split second thought again about racing off to another street. Then something snapped. He yanked open his door, flipped the bird at the BMW, and started for it. The horn continued. Rick walked to the driver's window, yelling something about getting out. The horn continued. Behind the wheel was a 40-year-old asshole in a dark suit with a dark overcoat and dark leather driving gloves. He would not look at Rick, but chose instead to press the horn and stare straight ahead. "Get out of the car!" Rick yelled. The horn continued. Now there was another car behind the BMW, and another was approaching. There was no way around the Fiat, and its driver wasn't ready to drive. The horn continued. "Get out of the car!" Rick yelled again. He thought of Judge Franco. God bless him. The car behind the BMW began honking too, and for good measure, Rick flipped the bird in its direction too. How exactly was this going to end? The driver of the second car, a woman, rolled down her window and yelled something unpleasant. Rick yelled back. More horns, more yelling, more cars approaching on a street that had been completely silent 1 minute earlier. Rick heard a car door slam and turned to watch a young woman start his Fiat, shift it quickly into reverse, and thrust it perfectly into the parking space. One easy effort, with no bumps or scrapes, second or third tries. It seemed physically impossible. The Fiat came to rest with 12 inches between it and the car in front, and the same for the car in the rear. The BMW roared by, as did the other cars. When they passed, the Fiat's driver's door opened and the young woman jumped out, opened toe pumps, really nice legs, and began walking away. Rick watched for a second, his heart still laboring from the encounter, his blood pumping, his fists clenched. "Hey!" Rick yelled. She did not flinch, did not hesitate. "Hey, thanks!" She kept walking, fading into the night. Rick watched her without moving, mesmerized by the miracle at hand. There was something familiar about her figure, her elegance, her hair. And then it hit him. "Gabriella!" he yelled. What was there to lose? If it wasn't her, then she wouldn't stop, would she? But she stopped. He walked toward her, and they met under a street lamp. He wasn't sure what to say, so he started to say something stupid like, "Grazie." But she said, "Who are you?" "English. Nice English." "My name's Rick. I'm American. Thanks for, that." He was pointing awkwardly in the general direction of his car. Her eyes were large and soft and still sad.
"How do you know my name?"
she asked.
"I saw you on stage last night. You were magnificent."
A moment of surprise, then a smile. The smile was the clincher. Perfect teeth, dimples, and her eyes sparkled.
"Thank you."
But he had the impression she did not smile often.
Anyway, I just wanted to say, hello.
Hello.
You live around here? He asked.
I'm close.
Got time for a drink? Another smile.
Sure.
The pub was owned by a man from Wales, and it attracted Anglos who ventured into Parma. Fortunately, it was Monday, and the place was quiet. They found a table near the front window. Rick ordered a beer, and Gabriella ordered a Campari and ice, a drink he had never heard of.
Your English is beautiful, he said. At that moment, everything about her was beautiful.
I lived in London for 6 years, after university, she said.
He guessed she was about 25, but perhaps she was closer to 30.
What were you doing in London?
I studied at the London College of Music, then I worked with the Royal Opera.
Are you from Parma?
No, Florence. And you, Mr...
Dockery. It's an Irish name.
Are you from Parma?
They both laughed to relieve some tension.
No, I grew up in Iowa, in the Midwest. Have you been to the U.S.?
Twice, on tour. I've seen most of the major cities.
So have I. A little tour of my own.
Rick had deliberately picked a round table that was small. They were sitting close together, drinks in front of them, knees not too far apart, both working hard to appear relaxed.
What kind of tour?
I play professional football. My career is not working out so well, and now I'm in Parma this season, playing for the Panthers.
He had a hunch that her career might be a bit off track, too, so he felt comfortable being completely honest. Her eyes encouraged honesty.
The Panthers?
Yes, there is a professional football league here in Italy. Few people know about it, mainly teams here in the north, Bologna, Milan, Bergamo, a few others.
I've never heard of it.
American football is not very popular here. As you know, this is soccer country.
Oh, yes.
She seemed less than enthused about soccer. She sipped the reddish liquid in her glass.
How long have you been here?
3 weeks. And you?
Since December. The season ends in a week, and I'll go back to Florence.
She looked away sadly, as if Florence was not where she wanted to be. Rick sipped his beer and looked blankly at an old dartboard on the wall.
I saw you at dinner tonight, he said. At Il Tribunale, you were with someone?
A quick, fake grin, then,
yes, that's Carletto, my boyfriend.
Another pause as Rick decided not to pursue this. If she wanted to talk about her boyfriend, it was up to her.
He lives in Florence, too, she said. We've been together for 7 years.
That's a long time.
Yes. Do you have someone?
No, I've never had a serious girlfriend. Lots of girls, but nothing serious.
Why not?
Hard to say. I've enjoyed being a bachelor. It's natural when you're a professional athlete.
Where did you learn to drive?
She blurted, and they laughed.
I've never had a car with a clutch, he said. Evidently you have.
Driving is different here, so is parking.
You are superb at parking and singing.
Thank you.
A beautiful smile, a pause, a sip from a glass.
You're an opera fan.
I am now, Rick almost said. Last night was my first, and I enjoyed it, especially when you were on stage, which wasn't often enough.
You must come again.
When?
We perform Wednesday, and then Sunday is our last of the season.
We play in Milan on Sunday.
I can get you a ticket for Wednesday.
It's a deal.
The pub closed at 2 a.m. Rick offered to walk her home, and she easily agreed. Her hotel suite was furnished by the opera company. It was near the river, a few blocks from the Teatro Reggio. They said goodnight with a nod, a smile, a promise to meet the next day. They met for lunch, and over large salads and crepes they talked for 2 hours. Her schedule was not that different from his. A long night's sleep, coffee and breakfast late in the morning, an hour or two at the gym, then an hour or two of work. When they were not performing, the cast was expected to gather and grind through another practice, same as football. Rick got the clear impression that a struggling soprano earned more than a struggling itinerant quarterback, but not by much. Carletto was never mentioned. They talked about their careers. She had begun singing as a young teenager in Florence, where her mother still lived. Her father was dead.
At 17, she began winning awards and receiving auditions. Her voice developed early, and there were big dreams. She worked hard in London and won role after role. But then nature set in. Genetics became a factor, and she was struggling with the realization that her career, her voice, had reached its pinnacle. Rick had been booed so many times it didn't faze him, but to get booed on an opera stage seemed unusually cruel. He wanted an explanation, but he did not bring up the issue. Instead, he asked questions about Othello. If he was going to watch it again the following night, he wanted to understand everything. Othello was dissected for a long time as the lunch went on. There was no hurry. After coffee, they went for a walk and found a gelato stand. When they finally said goodbye, Rick went straight to the gym, where he sweated like a madman for 2 hours and thought of nothing but Gabriella. Chapter 15. Due to a rugby conflict, Wednesday's practice began at 6 p.m. and was much worse than Monday's. In a cold, light rain, the Panthers slogged through 30 minutes of uninspired calisthenics and sprints, and when they were over, it was too wet for anything else. The team hurried back to the locker room, where Alex arranged the video and Coach Russo tried to get serious about the Milan Rhinos, an expansion team that had played the year before in the B division. For this reason alone, the Panthers had no trouble dismissing them as a viable opponent. There were jokes and cheap shots and plenty of laughs as Sam rolled the video. Finally, he switched discs and went back to their game against Naples. He began with a sequence of missed blocks by the offensive line, and before long, Nino was bickering with Franco. Paolo, the Texas Aggie and left tackle, took offense at something said by Silvio, a linebacker, and the mood turned nasty. The cheap shots grew more pointed and spread around the locker room. The squabbling took on sharper tones. Alex, handling the Italian now, offered scathing critiques of just about everyone in a black jersey. Rick sat low in his locker, enjoying the bitch session, but also aware of what Sam was doing. Sam wanted trouble, infighting, emotions. Often an ugly practice or a nasty film session can be productive. The team was flat and overconfident. When the lights came on, Sam told everyone to go home. There was little chatter as they showered and changed. Rick sneaked away from the stadium and hurried to his apartment. He changed into his finest Italian threads and at 8 p.m. sharp was seated in the fifth row from the orchestra in Teatro Reggio. He knew Othello now, inside and out. Gabriella had explained everything. He endured Act One, no Desdemona until the third scene, when she eased onto the stage and began groveling at the feet of her husband, the crazy Othello. Rick watched her carefully, and with perfect timing, as Othello wailed on about something, she glanced at the fifth row to make sure he was there. Then she began to sing, back and forth with Othello as the first act came to a close. Rick waited for a second, maybe two, then began applauding. The hefty signora to his right was at first startled, then slowly put her hands together and followed his lead. Her husband did the same, and the light applause spread. Those inclined to boo were preempted, and suddenly the crowd en masse decided that Desdemona deserved better than what she had been receiving. Emboldened, and not one to give much of a damn anyway, Rick served up a hearty bravo! A gentleman two rows back, no doubt as struck by Desdemona's beauty as Rick, did the same. A few other enlightened souls agreed, and as the curtain fell, Gabriella stood at center stage, eyes closed, but with a slightly noticeable smile. At 1 a.m., they were in the Welsh pub again, having drinks and talking opera and football. The final performance of Othello would be the following Sunday, when the Panthers were in Milan, slugging it out with the Rhinos. She wanted to see a game, and Rick convinced her to stay in Parma another week. With Paolo the Aggie as their guide, the three Americans caught the 10:05 train from Milan Friday night, not long after the last practice of the week. The rest of the Panthers were at Polipo's for the weekly pizza party. The drink cart stopped at their seats, and Rick bought four beers, the first round, the first of many. Sly said he drank little, said his wife did not approve, but at that moment his wife was in Denver, very far away. She would become even more removed as the night progressed. Trey said he preferred bourbon, but could certainly handle a beer. Paolo seemed ready to drink a keg. An hour later, they were in the sprawling lights of Milan's perimeter. Paolo claimed to know the city well.
and the country boy was visibly excited about a weekend in town. The train stopped inside the cavernous Milano Centrale, Europe's largest train station, a place that had thoroughly intimidated Rick a month earlier when he passed through. They squeezed into a cab and headed for the hotel. Paolo had handled the details. They had decided on a decent hotel, not too expensive, in a section of town known for its nightlife. No cultural excursion into the heart of old Milan. No interest in history or art. Sly, in particular, had seen enough cathedrals and baptistries and cobblestone streets. They checked into the Hotel Gianni in the northwest section of Milan. It was a family-run albergo, with a little charm and little rooms. Double rooms, with Sly and Trey in one and Rick and Paolo in the other. The narrow beds were not far apart, and Rick wondered, as he quickly unpacked, just how cozy things might get if both roommates got lucky with the girls. Food was a priority, at least for Paolo, though the Americans could have grabbed a sandwich on the run. He selected a place called Quattro Mori because of its fish, said he needed a break from the endless pasta and meat in Parma. They ate freshly caught pike from Lake Garda and fried perch from Lake Como, but the winner was a baked tench stuffed with breadcrumbs, Parmesan cheese, and parsley. Paolo, of course, preferred a slow, proper meal with wine, followed by dessert and coffee. The Americans were ready for the bars. The first was an establishment known as a disco pub, a genuine Irish pub with a long happy hour followed by wall-to-wall dancing. They arrived around 2 a.m., and the pub was rocking with a screeching British punk band and hundreds of young men and women gyrating wildly with the music. They drained a few beers and approached a few ladies. The language thing was quite a barrier. The second was a pricier club with a 10-euro cover charge, but Paolo knew someone who knew someone else, and the cover was waived. They found a table on the second level and watched the band and dance floor below. A bottle of Danish vodka arrived with four glasses of ice, and the evening took a different turn. Rick flashed a credit card and paid for the drinks. Sly and Trey were on tight budgets, as was Paolo, though he tried not to show it. Rick, the quarterback, at 20 grand a year, was happy enough to play the big shot. Paolo disappeared and returned with three women, three very attractive Italian girls willing at least to say hello to the Americans. One spoke broken English, but after a few minutes of awkward chit-chat, they resorted to Italian with Paolo, and the Americans were gently pushed to the sidelines.
"How do you pick up girls if they can't speak English?" Rick asked Sly.
"My wife speaks English." Then Trey led one of the girls away to the dance floor.
"These European girls," Sly said, "always checking out the black dudes."
"Must be awful."
After an hour, the Italians moved on. The vodka was gone. The party began sometime after 4 a.m. when they stepped into a packed Bavarian beer hall with a reggae band on stage. English was the dominant tongue. Lots of American students and 20-somethings. On the way back from the bar with four steins of beer, Rick found himself cornered by a group of ladies from the South, according to their drawls.
"Dallas," one said.
They were travel agents, all in their mid-30s and probably married, though no wedding rings were visible. Rick sat the beers on their table and offered them up. To hell with his teammates. There was no brotherhood. Within seconds, he was dancing with Beverly, a slightly overweight redhead with beautiful skin, and when Beverly danced, it was full contact. The floor was crowded, bodies bumped into bodies, and to keep close, Beverly kept her hands on Rick. She hugged and hunched and groped, and between songs suggested they retire to a corner where they could be alone, away from her competition. She was a clinger, and a determined one. There was no sign of the other Panthers. But Rick guided her back to her table, where her fellow travel agents were assaulting all manner of men. He danced with one named Lisa from Houston, whose ex-husband ran off with his law partner, and so on. She was a bore, and of the two, he preferred Beverly. Paolo popped in to check on his quarterback, and with his accented English, thrilled the ladies with an amazing string of lies. He and Rick were famous rugby players from Rome who traveled the world with their team, earning millions and living life in grand style. Rick rarely lied to pick up women. It simply wasn't necessary. But it was humorous to watch the Italian work the crowd. Sly and Trey were gone, Paolo told Rick as he moved to another table. Left with two blondes who spoke the language, albeit with a funny accent. Probably Irish, he thought. After the third dance, maybe the fourth, Beverly finally convinced him to leave, through a side door to avoid her friends. They walked a few blocks, completely lost, then found a cab.
They groped for 10 minutes in the back seat until it stopped at the Regency. Her room was on the 5th floor. As Rick pulled the curtains, he saw the first hint of dawn. He managed to open one eye in the early afternoon, and with it he saw red toenails and realized Bev was still asleep. He closed it and drifted away. His head felt worse the second time he awoke. She was not in the bed but in the shower, and for a few minutes he thought about his escape. Though the disentanglement and clumsy goodbye would be over quickly, he still hated it. He always had. Was cheap sex really worth the lies on the run? Hey, you were great. Gotta go now. Sure, I'll give you a call. How many times had he opened his eyes, tried to remember the girl's name, tried to remember where he found her, tried to recall the details of the actual deed, the momentous occasion that got them into bed to begin with? The shower was running. His clothes were in a pile by the door. He suddenly felt older, not necessarily more mature, but certainly tired of the role of the bed-hopping bachelor with the golden arm. All the women had been throwaways, from the cute cheerleaders in college to this stranger in a foreign city. The football stud act was over. It ended in Cleveland with his last real game. He thought of Gabriella, then tried not to. How odd that he felt guilty lying under thin sheets listening to the water run over the body of a woman whose last name he never heard. He quickly dressed and waited. The water stopped, and Bev walked out in a hotel bathrobe.
"So, you're awake," she said with a forced smile.
"Finally," he said, standing and anxious to get it over with. He hoped she didn't stall and want drinks and dinner and another night of it. "I need to go."
"So long,"
she said, then abruptly returned to the bathroom and shut the door. He heard the lock click. How wonderful. In the hallway, he decided that she was indeed married, and she probably felt a lot guiltier than he did. Over beer and pizza, the four amigos nursed their hangovers and compared stories. Rick, to his surprise, found such frat boy talk silly. "Ever hear the 48-hour rule?" he asked, and before anyone could answer, he said, "It's pretty common in pro football. No booze 48 hours before kickoff." "Kickoff is in about 20 hours, Trey said.
"So much for that rule," Sly said, gulping his beer.
"I say we take it easy tonight," Rick said. The other three nodded, but did not commit. They found a half-empty disco pub and threw darts for an hour as the place filled and a band tuned up in one corner. Suddenly the pub was flooded with German college students, most of them female and all of them ready for a hard night. The darts were forgotten when the dancing began. A lot of things were forgotten. American football was less popular in Milan than in Parma. Someone said there were 100,000 Yanks living in Milan, and evidently most hated football. A couple hundred fans showed up for the kickoff. The Rhinos' home was an old soccer field with a few sections of bleachers. The team had labored for years in Series B before being promoted this season. They were no match for the mighty Panthers, which made it hard to explain their 20-point lead at halftime. The first half was Sam's worst nightmare. As he anticipated, the team was flat and lackadaisical, and no amount of screaming could motivate them. After 4 carries, Sly was on the sideline gasping and heaving. Franco fumbled the ball away on his first and only carry. His ace quarterback seemed a bit slow, and his passes were uncatchable. 2 were batted around long enough for the Rhino's safety to grab them. Rick fumbled one hand off and refused to run the ball. His feet felt like bricks. As they jogged off the field at halftime, Sam went after his quarterback. "You hung over?" he demanded rather loudly, or at least loud enough for the rest of the team to hear. "How long you been in Milan?" "All weekend? You been drunk all weekend? You look like shit, and you play like shit, you know that." "Thanks, coach," Rick said, still jogging. Sam stayed beside him step for step, and the Italians got out of the way. "You're supposed to be the leader, right?" "Thanks, coach." "And you show up all red-eyed and hungover and you can't hit a barn with a pass? You make me sick, you know that?" "Thanks, coach." Inside the locker room, Alex Oliveto took over in Italian, and it was not pretty. Many of the Panthers glared at Rick and Sly, who was gritting his teeth and fighting nausea. Trey had made no great errors in the first half, but he'd certainly done nothing spectacular. Paolo, so far, had been able to survive by hiding in the mass of humanity at the line of scrimmage. The flashback. The hospital room in Cleveland.
watching ESPN highlights and wanting to reach up to the IV bag and turn the valve so that the Vicodin could flow freely into his bloodstream and put him out of his misery. Where were the chemicals when he needed them? And why, exactly, did he love this game? When Alex grew tired, Franco asked the coaches to leave the room, which they gladly did. The judge then addressed his teammates. Without raising his voice, he pleaded for a greater effort. There was plenty of time. The Rhinos were an inferior bunch. All of this was in Italian, but Rick got the message. The comeback began in dramatic fashion, and was over before it really started. On the second play of the second half, Sly darted through the line and raced 65 yards for an easy touchdown. But by the time he reached the end zone, he was done for the day. He barely made it back to the sideline before crouching behind the bench and disgorging the entire weekend's worth of hell-raising. Rick heard it, but preferred not to look. There was a flag, and after some discussion, the play was called back. Nino had yanked a linebacker's face mask, then placed a knee in his groin. Nino was ejected. And though this fired up the Panthers, it also infuriated the Rhinos. The cursing and taunting reached a nasty level, and Rick picked the wrong time to bootleg and run. He gained 15 yards and, to prove his determination, lowered his helmet instead of stepping out of bounds. He was slaughtered by half the Rhinos' defense. He staggered back to the huddle and called a pass play to Fabrizio. The new center, a 40-year-old named Sandro, bobbled the snap. The ball shot loose from the line, and Rick managed to fall on it. A large and angry tackle drilled him into the ground for good measure. On 3rd and 14, he fired a pass at Fabrizio. The bullet was much too hard and hit the kid in the helmet, which he promptly removed and threw angrily at Rick as they left the field. Fabrizio then left the field, too. He was last seen jogging toward the locker room. With no running game and no passing game, Rick's offense was left with few options. Franco punched the ball into the middle of the pile-up over and over, quite heroically. Late in the fourth quarter, trailing 34-0, Rick sat alone on the bench and watched the defense struggle valiantly to save face. Pietro and Silvio, the two psycho linebackers, hit like wild men and screamed at their defense to kill whoever had the ball. If Rick had ever felt worse late in a football game, he could not remember when. He got himself benched on the last possession. "Take a break," Sam hissed at him, and Alberto jogged the huddle. The drive took 10 plays, all on the ground, and consumed 4 minutes. Franco pounded into the middle, and Andreo, Sly's replacement, swept right and left with little speed, few moves, but a gritty determination. Playing for nothing but pride, the Panthers finally scored with 10 seconds to go when Franco lurched his way into the end zone. The extra point was blocked. The bus ride home was slow and painful. Rick was given a seat by himself and suffered alone. The coaches sat in the front and seethed. Someone with a cell phone got the news that Bergamo had beaten Naples 42-7 in Naples, and this made a bad day even worse. Chapter 16. Mercifully, the Gazzetta di Parma did not mention the game. Sam read the sports page early Monday morning and for once was happy to be lost in the land of soccer. He flipped through the paper while parked on the curb outside the Hotel Palace Maria Luigia, waiting for Hank and Claudel Withers from Topeka. He'd spent last Saturday showing them the highlights of the Po Valley, and now they wanted a full day seeing more. He wished he could have spent Sunday with them as well, and skipped Milan. His cell phone rang. "Hello? Sam, it's Rick." Sam skipped a beat, thought some terrible things, then said, "What's up? Where are you?" "I'm a guide today. Why? You got a minute?" "No. As I said, I'm working now." "Where are you?" "Outside the Hotel Palace Maria Luigia. Be there in 5 minutes." Minutes later, Rick turned the corner, running hard and sweating as if he'd been at it for an hour. Sam slowly removed himself from the car and leaned against a fender. Rick pulled alongside, stopped on the sidewalk, took a couple of deep breaths and said, "Nice car." He pretended to admire the black Mercedes. Sam had little to say, so he said, "It's a rental." Another deep breath, a step closer. "Sorry about yesterday," Rick said, eyeball to eyeball with his coach. "It might be a party for you," Sam growled, "but it's my job." "You have the right to be pissed." "Oh, thank you." "It won't happen again." "Damned right it won't."
You show up again in bad shape and I'll bench your ass. I'd rather lose with Alberto and a little dignity than lose with some prima donna with a hangover. You were pretty disgusting. Go ahead, unload. I got it coming. You lost more than a game yesterday. You lost your team. They weren't exactly ready to play. True, but don't pass the buck. You're the key, whether you like it or not. They feed off you, or at least they did. Rick watched a few cars pass, then backed away. I'm sorry, Sam. It won't happen again. We'll see. Hank and Claudel emerged from the hotel and said good morning to their guide. Later, Sam hissed at Rick, then got in the car. Gabriella's Sunday had been as disastrous as Rick's. In the final performance of Otello, she had been flat and uninspired, according to her own critique, and evidently according to the audience as well. She reluctantly explained things over a light lunch, and though Rick wanted to know if they had actually booed her again, he did not ask. She was cheerless and preoccupied, and Rick tried to lighten her mood by describing his pathetic game in Milan. Misery loves company, and he was certain his performance was much worse than hers. It didn't work. Halfway through the meal, she informed him, sadly, that she was leaving in a few hours for Florence. She needed to go home, to get away from Parma and the pressure of the stage. You promised to stay another week, he said, trying not to sound desperate.
No, I must go.
I thought you wanted to see a football game.
I did, but now I don't. I'm sorry, Rick.
He stopped eating and tried to appear supportive and nonchalant, but he was an easy read.
I'm sorry,
she said, but he doubted her sincerity. Is it Carletto?
No.
I think it is.
Carletto is always there, somewhere. He's not going away. We've been together too long.
Exactly. Much too long. Dump the creep and let's have some fun. Rick bit his tongue and decided not to beg. They had been together for 7 years, and their relationship was certainly complicated. Wedging into the middle of it, or even working the edges, would get him burned. He inched his plate away and folded his hands. Her eyes were wet, but she was not crying. She was a wreck. She had reached the point on stage where her career was teetering on the brink. Rick suspected Carletto offered more threats than support, though how could he ever know for sure? And so it ended like most of the other quick romances he'd botched along the way. A hug on the sidewalk, an awkward kiss, a tear or two from her, goodbyes, promises to call, and finally, a fleeting wave of the hand. As he watched her disappear down the street, though, he longed to race after her and beg like a fool. He prayed she would stop and quickly turn around and come running back. He walked a few blocks, trying to knock off the numbness, and when that didn't work, he changed into running gear and jogged to Stadio Lanfranchi. The locker room was empty, except for Matteo, the trainer, who did not offer a massage. He was sufficiently pleasant, but something was missing from his usual jovial self. Matteo wanted to study sports medicine in the United States, and for this reason gave Rick loads of unwanted attention. Today, the kid was preoccupied, and soon disappeared. Rick stretched out on the training table, closed his eyes, and thought about the girl. Then he thought about Sam, and his plan to catch him early before practice, and, tail wagging, try once more to repair the damage. He thought about the Italians, and almost dreaded the cold shoulders. But as a race, they were not prone to keep their feelings bottled up, and he figured that after a few testy encounters and harsh words, they would all hug and be pals again. Hey, buddy, someone whispered and jolted him from his zone. It was Sly, wearing jeans and a jacket and headed somewhere. Rick sat up and dangled his feet off the table. What's up?
You seen Sam?
He's not here yet. Where are you going? Sly leaned on the other training table, folded his arms, frowned, and in a low voice said,
Home, Ricky. I'm headed home.
You're quitting?
Call it whatever. We all quit at some point.
You can't just walk out, Sly, after 2 games? Come on.
I'm packed, and the train leaves in an hour. My lovely wife will be waiting at the airport in Denver when I get there tomorrow. I gotta go, Ricky. It's over.
I'm tired of chasing a dream that'll never happen. I think I understand that, Sly, but you're walking out in the middle of a season. You're leaving me with a backfield in which no one runs the 40 in under 5 seconds except me, and I'm not supposed to run.
Sly was nodding, his eyes glancing around. He obviously hoped to sneak in, have a few words with Sam, then sneak out.
Rick wanted to choke him because the thought of handing off to Judge Franco 20 times a game was not appealing.
I got no choice, Rick, he said, even softer, even sadder. My wife called this morning, pregnant, and very surprised to be pregnant. She's fed up. She wants a real husband at home. And what am I doing over here anyway, chasing girls in Milan like I'm still in college? We're kidding ourselves.
You committed to play this season. You're leaving us with no running game, Sly. That's not fair.
Nothing's fair.
The decision was made, and bickering wouldn't change anything. As Yanks, they'd been forced together in a foreign land. They had survived together and had fun doing so, but they would never be close friends.
They'll find somebody else, Sly said, standing straight, ready to bolt.
They pick up players all the time.
During the season?
Sure, you watch. Sam will have a tail back by Sunday.
Rick relaxed a little.
You coming home in July? Sly asked.
Sure.
You gonna try out somewhere?
I don't know.
You get to Denver, give me a call, okay?
Sure.
A quick manly hug and Sly was gone. Rick watched him dart through the side door, and he knew he would never see him again. And Sly would never again see Rick, or Sam, or any of the Italians. He would vanish from Italy and never return.
An hour later, Rick broke the news to Sam, who'd had a very long day with Hank and Claudel. Sam actually threw a magazine against the wall while unloading the expected stream of profanities, and when he settled down, he said,
You know any running backs?
Yes, a great one, Franco. Ha ha. Americans, preferably college players who run real fast.
Not right offhand.
Can you call your agent?
I could, but he hasn't been real prompt returning my calls. I think he has unofficially dumped me.
You're on a roll.
I'm having a very good day, Sam.
Chapter 17. At 8 o'clock, Monday evening, the Panthers began arriving at the field. The mood was quiet and gloomy. They were embarrassed by the loss, and the news that half the offense had just fled town did not help their spirits. Rick sat on a stool in front of his locker, his back to everyone, his head buried in the playbook. He could feel the stares and the resentment, and he knew he had been terribly wrong. Maybe it was just a club sport. But winning meant something. Commitment meant even more. He slowly flipped the pages, looking blankly at the X's and O's. Whoever created them assumed the offense had a tailback who could run and a receiver who could catch. Rick could deliver the ball, but if there was no one on the other end, the stats simply recorded another incompletion. Fabrizio had not been seen. His locker was empty. Sam got their attention and had a few measured words for the team. No sense yelling. His players felt bad enough. Yesterday's game was over, and there was another in 6 days. He delivered the news about Sly, though the gossip had made the rounds. Their next opponent was Bologna, traditionally a strong team that usually played in the Super Bowl. Sam talked about the Warriors and made them sound rather fierce. They had easily won their first two games with a punishing ground attack, led by a tailback named Montrose, who had once played at Rutgers. Montrose was new to the league, and his legend was growing by the week. Yesterday, against the Rome Gladiators, he carried the ball 28 times for over 300 yards and 4 touchdowns. Pietro vowed loudly to break his leg, and this was well received by the team. After a half-hearted pep talk, the team filed out of the locker room and jogged onto the field. The day after a game, most of the players were stiff and sore. Alex worked them gently through some light stretching and exercises, then they divided into offense and defense. Rick's suggestion for a new offense was to move Trey from free safety to wide receiver and throw him the ball 30 times a game. Trey had speed, great hands, quickness, and he'd played wideout in high school. Sam was cool to the idea, primarily because it came from Rick, and at the moment he was barely talking to his quarterback. Halfway through the workout, though, Sam issued an open call for anyone who might consider playing receiver. Rick and Alberto tossed easy passes to a dozen prospects for half an hour, after which Sam called Trey over and made the switch. His presence on offense left a huge gap on defense.
If we can't stop them, maybe we can outscore them, Sam mumbled as he scratched his cap. Let's go watch film, he said, and then blew his whistle.
Monday night film meant cold beer and some laughs. Exactly what the team needed. Bottles of Peroni, the national favorite, were handed out, and the mood lightened considerably. Sam chose to ignore the Rhinos tape and dwell on Bologna. On defense, the Warriors were big across the front and had a strong safety who had played 2 years of arena ball and hit really hard. A headhunter. Just what I need, thought Rick, as he pulled a long gulp of beer. Another concussion. Montrose looked a step or two slow. The Rome defenders, much slower. And Pietro and Silvio soon dismissed him as a threat.
We shall crush him, Pietro said in plain English,